You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the weekend, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 461 of the Columbia Calling podcast. How did you feel about the rerun of Wade Davis's interview last week? We were short on interviews, but at the same time, I think it was great to bring it back out, pull it out into the open again after 2 years. Things have been very timely, of course, with Mr. Wade Davis, and a lot of you tuned in for the second time and many more for the first time. So there you go. I think it was important to get perhaps one of our most notable and famous interviewees back on the show. I have actually talked to him in the last couple of weeks, but he's too busy to update or bring us more information from his life at the moment, but hopefully something in the future. Of course, we were talking about his book Magdalena, River of Memories, and it's his love story to Colombia. Of course, it really is an ode to Colombia from Wade Davis there. But this week's episode is special in that you'll notice that I managed to geek out entirely on it as well. And this is with Camila González Rosas. And she is, well, she's a doctor, etc. But she is the head of the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Los Andes here in Bogota. And she is a parasitologist. And she will explain to us what is disease ecology. And we talk all about infectious and tropical diseases here in Colombia. And not least, of course, we do have to get on to the issue of COVID-19. You may be bored of it, but we cover Chagas, we cover leishmaniasis, we cover Zika, chikungunya, dengue, malaria, and of course COVID. So it's a fascinating conversation with someone who's really dedicated her life to this study and very incredible research and investigations at these centers that she works at. So we are very, very honored and, of course, humbled to have someone of this academic profile on the show talking about infectious diseases and disease ecology in Colombia. So we will be with her in segment three. Thank you again to Mark in Toronto. Mark, who has upgraded his Patreon donation. So thank you to you there. And of course, all of you out there, if you want to support the Columbia Calling podcast, that's www.patreon.com/Columbia Calling. And you can help us out for less than the cost of a Starbucks coffee just once a month. And yes, we'll be over now to our sponsors, and then on to the Columbia News Brief with Emily Hart, as always, and then back with Camila González Rosas talking about all these creepy crawlies and infectious diseases in Colombia. So thank you again, and don't go away.
The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. The Columbia Calling podcast is also proud to say that we are sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator in Colombia, providing a large range of private day tours, transportation, and bespoke packages throughout Colombia since 2017. By popular demand, from January 2023, they will be providing exclusive small group shared tours for those aged 50 and over. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a private package of your own, just complete the form on the Columbia Calling website, that's columbiacalling.co, or the Plan My Trip form on the BNB Colombia Tours website, That's bnbcolombia.com. And they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all your questions and to start the planning of your Colombia adventure. So please support our sponsors, our patrons here on the Colombia Calling Podcast. That's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you again.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your top stories for the week of March 13th, 2023. The second round of peace talks with guerrilla group National Liberation Army, the ELN, have been taking place in Mexico, where a final agenda has been laid out after a bilateral ceasefire was signed. The agenda is based on citizen participation, meaningful democracy, and socioeconomic transformation. Cuba has been announced as the next location for negotiations, which are due to start in April. Cuba was the location for the final negotiation of the peace deal with guerrilla group the FARC, but its selection is also a sign of healing diplomatic relations between Colombia and Cuba, which suffered major setbacks under the mandate of former President Iván Duque. As part of the talks, the political status of the ELN was recognized in an official government decree, a key demand of the group to differentiate them from other armed groups in the country and diminish emphasis on their links with the drug trade. Meanwhile, former commander of paramilitary group Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia, Salvatore Mancuso, is calling for recognition of armed group the Clan del Golfo as a political entity and peace talks on that basis, claiming that it's an oversimplification to see the group as just criminals or to see the ELN as a political entity, given that all groups, without exception, he said, are financed by drug trafficking. Mancuso himself was accused of directing nearly 150 massacres during his time as commander, among numerous other crimes. He made his suggestions from a prison in the USA. The director of the National Unit for Protection, Augusto Rodriguez, was attacked outside his home last week. The UNP is tasked with protecting individuals at high risk of violent attack. Since Rodriguez's arrival in office, he has reported irregularity and corruption at various levels, including UNP vehicles used to transport drugs, the provision of fake armor, and the involvement of mafia in service contracts. He says he has not ruled out the possibility that the attackers were contractors whose irregular practices he had denounced within the unit. His bodyguard was wounded in an exchange of bullets which left one of his attackers dead. Meanwhile, Colombia and Ecuador have launched a joint alert system to protect indigenous Awá communities from attacks by armed groups in the border region, in which around 30,000 members of that community live, often at high risk of murder, displacement, landmines, and recruitment of minors, of whom around 8 are recruited per month, according to Colombia's ombudsman. Both the ELN and FARC guerrilla dissidents, as well as other criminal groups, are active in the area, both involved in drug trafficking and illegal mining. Former officials of the Attorney General's office, from the mandate of Néstor Humberto Martínez, have been charged with crimes including fraud and destruction of evidence with the aim of obstructing the Special Peace Tribunal, known as the JEP, principally in relation to the attempted extradition of former FARC leader Jesús Santrich. It was a controversial moment in the peace process which ultimately led to Santrich abandoning the peace agreement and joining dissident troops. In fact, many consider that the Attorney General's office during that time was working against the peace agreement. The Truth Commission last year accused Martínez of planning an operation with the DEA to intentionally involve Santrich in the drug business, which would then allow his extradition. The Truth Commission called this moment a breaking point for a faction of the FARC to take up arms again, in the face of a faltering agreement and lack of faith in institutions which seemed actively to be working against it. Strikes have continued in Antioquia to protest military operations against informal mining. Demonstrators are requesting formalization of their work and decent working conditions. Various illegal dredging machines were destroyed by the government, sparking protests and roadblocks in 12 municipalities. More than 20 have been injured in clashes, and up to 300,000 people in the area suffered a shortage of food and medical supplies. The government said that the machines were causing environmental disaster, including contamination of rivers with mercury. Roadblocks have now mostly been lifted, but protest continues and no resolution has yet been reached. Both the Minister of Defense and the Governor of Antioquia suggested involvement by armed group the Clan del Golfo, though the group have come out in denial of the accusation. Nevertheless, after an attack on an aqueduct which left many without running water, President Gustavo Petro has openly accused the Clan del Golfo of breaking the bilateral ceasefire agreed at the end of last year in pursuit of total peace negotiations. On Wednesday, marches for International Women's Day took place across the country, with thousands on the streets of all major cities protesting ongoing femicides and violence against women in Colombia. Later in the week, a new protocol for the prevention of gender-based violence and discrimination was signed into law, covering all contractors, employees, and procurement bodies of the public sector. Also this week, a law was signed to replace prison sentences for mothers who are heads of their household. It will affect around 5,000 women. The director of Colombia's police force, meanwhile, used the day to publicly share biblical values considered essential in women, including discretion, charm, modesty, and reserve. Henry Sanabria's appointment was considered controversial as he opposes abortion and same-sex marriage, allegedly even persecuting LGBTQ people when he was head of police command in Cartagena. The transport superintendency has taken control of Viva Air, which may be subjected to a reorganization process, freezing debts in order to avoid bankruptcy. It is reported that 16,000 passengers per day have been affected since it ceased operations last week. The state will now effectively decide whether or not the airline survives or goes into liquidation. The company blames the state for the crisis as it rejected an integration with Avianca last year on the grounds that that merge would create a monopoly over national routes. Major banks, including Bancolombia, Banco de Bogotá and Davivienda, have lowered their interest rates, some by up to 20%, in hopes of curbing the spate of credit card cancellations in the country caused by raised rates, which had hoped to bring inflation under control. The announcements came after Petro asked the financial system to lower rates and avoid a banking crisis due to the inability of users trapped in debt to pay their loans. Those were your top stories for this week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. This is episode 461 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is a very special episode for me. And those of you who listen to the podcast will know that I have topics that are closer to my heart. They have topics that sort of, let's say, inspire me more. And one of those is the issue of epidemiology, not least because my wife is an epidemiologist, but also tropical diseases, not least because I've suffered from many. So it means that it's a real honor to have someone of such an academic prowess as Dr. Camila González Rosas, who is the director and associate professor at the Department of Biological Sciences at the Universidad de los Andes, at downtown Bogota, and also a researcher for the Center for Investigation into Microbiology and Tropical Parasitology. So welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast, Camila.
Thank you, Richard. I'm so happy to be here and so honored for your invitation.
No, it's a real no. The honor is mine to get someone of your standing here who can talk about disease ecology, who can talk about tropical diseases, their spread, the potential jump, so zoonotic transmission, and so on and so forth. But I want to start from the very beginning. How does someone become an expert in such a niche field, such a fascinating field? Because you did your studies in Bogota, undergraduate, then you went to Mexico, and now you're back and you're kind of in charge.
Yeah. And you know, that is interesting what you're mentioning, because when I started to study, the term disease ecology was not really that popular. And if you would look at universities, like searching for labs working on this was not that common. And now I would say that in each university, you will have an expert on disease ecology. So I started studying this because I was very passionate about public health from the biology perspective. So I decided very early in my career that I wanted to keep working for communities and for people and do applied science. And I started with venomous animals, and then I moved to vector-borne diseases thanks to a researcher from the National Institute of Health, who practically adopted me and trained me on that subject. And there I started to work on leishmaniasis. But then I went to a meeting, to the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene meeting in Miami. And there I saw a talk showing lots of maps and diseases distribution. And I was like very fascinated about that. I took a course on geographic information systems while I was working in the National Institute of Health. So I was like trying to connect these passions. And so I talked to the researcher and he suggested to contact the researcher who had done these studies was Tom Peterson from University of Kansas. So I contacted him and I told him, I really like this. I would like to explore this, like spatial distribution and how diseases overlap and how species involved in transmission distribute. And so he was the one who advised me to go to Mexico to the lab, to the Geographic Information Systems lab, to do my postgraduate studies.
Wow. And so, I mean, just through sort of, let's say, some emails and phone calls, that was it. And so,
yeah.
And now you're, you know, obviously at the Center for Investigation and, of course, based in Colombia. But I want to ask, you know, so much of the country has been off limits for so long studying a spread of infectious diseases has to have been, well, you go through certain communities that you could have visited, and then did the military give you the rest of the information? Because, I mean, it was off limits. It was, you were unable to do this.
Well, the true story of my life is full of adventures, many of them quite dangerous. And yeah, really, to be honest, from my undergrad thesis, I was in a very, very difficult zone. So I would say that the advantage is that when you work with public health, doors are always open. So it's very important for the communities to have this kind of researchers and of workers visiting. So there's a system, a parallel system where you get to get permits to go to these zones. And it's very important always to make local contacts and to let everyone know that you are going there. Who are you? What are you going to do? But of course, I have been working in very difficult zones for all of my life, and it sometimes gets very scary. But anyways, I feel that it has happened to me many times that I feel that this is the last time that I have to make sense of what I am doing and not risk that much. Especially, I don't like when I have students or assistants with me to put them in difficult situations. Mm. But after a few years, I forget about everything and I'm back to those places or to other places having the same feelings. So no, we get our data ourselves. In some regions where it is very hard to access all the regions, we have local researchers or local contacts who do the difficult field work. And then we process the data or the samples that we collect.
It's, I mean, truly fascinating to go down to these areas. Of course, you have local contacts. You say you get the legal permits, but you have to also have the alternatively legal permits to be in these places. I was the first time I came to Colombia in 1998, I was working for an NGO and we were studying the mangroves in the Pacific. And that was, again, it was a different Colombia. And every time I, as a journalist, came in with a photographer, you can only imagine,
of course, yeah.
We would check in at the local priest's house and he would say, yeah, los muchachos, they know you're here.
Yes. That's very important because when we work with international researchers, usually they go on Google Earth and they look for very nice places with very nice forest coverage. And they come to me and they say, look, we want to go there and we will spend 7 nights there. And I'm like, no, that's not the way it works here. So you cannot just land and take a car and go everywhere you want. And because, of course, it's not the way you can work in a country like Colombia, unfortunately.
No, but I mean, I guess, I don't know. I guess I'd like to ask, actually, since the, you know, prior to 2016, immediately prior to 2016, when the bilateral ceasefire was going on, and then post 2016, when the peace accord was kind of being carried out, was this a real, like a bonanza time for research? You could get down to areas without real risk to yourself or to your students?
I would say that the places where we could go kind of changed, but there are still many places where you know that it's very hard to access. And I think that at some point also all the reorganization of these armed groups made also the process more complex, because now you don't know who will be there when you will go to the field. So anyways, we always do the previous search for the political situation in places where we go. And of course, we never take students to areas where there's any risk.
Well, yeah, you have to do the total risk assessment for these things. I mean, this is always of interest to me because as a journalist, before having children, I'd go down to these places. Now I have responsibilities and, you know, I'm very aware of my own mortality.
Yeah.
I think you're more courageous than me, in truth. I think you're more driven.
Or more crazy, I don't know, because I had a son when I was at the university. So I have been doing this in spite of being a mom during all of my life. So maybe it's...
Then you're definitely more crazy. So let's talk about this, because a lot of your studies, and I've read it, you've done Chagas and malaria and dengue and leishmaniasis. Leishmaniasis is one of those diseases that I find, again, it's one of those things that I find so very fascinating. I have not had leishmaniasis because it's that image of it, you know, the fly that bites you, and then the skin starts to disappear like a burn. And it's so very difficult to get rid of. And the drugs used are toxic. I had someone who had her PhD on her name, Lina Pinto did her PhD.
I know her.
Yeah, I knew.
She's very nice, yeah.
So about, I guess, 100 episodes ago, we were talking about that. And the conclusion that I was able to draw is that leishmaniasis expanded in the context of the armed conflict because of the soldiers and the guerrillas in these groups. And I just think, I read in your article, there's 9 species of leishmaniasis in 20 types of sandfly. And the data was, it said 60% of the population is at risk. And is this 60% of Colombia's population at risk, or areas that you studied?
No, is the area of the country, because you assume that all the population that lives under certain altitude where you can find the vectors is at risk, is potentially at risk.
Okay. That's it. So, and it's present in 28 of 32 departments. That's terrifying to me.
No, that's beautiful, because you know that what is very nice about this disease is that it's one of the diseases that is endemic from our country, that species are endemic. You are not working with an imported species, such as in the case of dengue, both vectors are imported species. So if you want to do ecology, having local species and local transmission like before humans were here in the continent. That's very fascinating because those species are part of our biodiversity, and we always are very proud of how biodiverse is our country, and we are also biodiverse in vectors and pathogens.
See, this is your background coming in. You get excited about leishmaniasis, but I did not know that it was. I did not know that dengue is an imported. Where does it come from?
Well, the mosquitoes came from Asia and from Africa. From ships probably carrying tires and other water sources. Mm-hmm. So we have the two species of mosquitoes imported in the country, and the virus as well came probably in persons who were infected. So
like
it's the same, like you, it's the same case as chikungunya or as Zika, that you have humans infected coming to the country, and if the mosquitoes are already here, they can establish the transmission cycle.
So if you've got like this, as you say, like, you know, dengue, obviously it reproduces in those puddles, still water, stagnant water, and so on, like in the tires. This is very contemporary. I mean, this is not a long, long time ago. Is that sort of since the 1950s, 60s, that kind of time?
Yes, it has been here for a quite, well, compared to the other diseases, it's a short period of time. And I don't know the dates exactly, but what I can tell you is that Aedes albopictus came first, and then we had Aedes, Aedes aegypti was the first one, and then we had like around the 90s Aedes albopictus coming to Colombia. So it's quite recent, but anyways, we have had the spread of the two species and albopictus. We have found albopictus in two places where they were not recorded. So each time we go to look for things, we find something new or something different.
Now, I get the idea from the research you've done and the stuff that you know, the data that you compile, that so much of all of these species and parasites exist in the Magdalena River Valley. Everything seems to go back to there. And it makes me think, so my wife is from Barranca Bermeja, and I think of La Troco and tropical oil, which then later becomes, you know, Ecopetrol and stuff. And these Americans who came down in the 40s to exploit. And I've since been to they call it the Cementerio de los Gringos, the cemetery of the gringos, just outside. And because they all died of yellow fever and malaria and dengue. And I mean, that's the heart of that swampy, ciénagas and rivers. So I think that so much of your research has been done around that area. And hence, when you talk about the dangerous places you went, it was pretty nasty down there for quite a long time.
Yes. But you know that that fortunately we have started to work in that area quite recently. And it was a very nice opportunity because when the Zika epidemic started here in America, a researcher from the CDC contacted me and he asked me, like, are you able to go to a place where we need to sample almost all the vertebrates that are present and the mosquitoes, because we want to answer the question if Zika is going to move to a silvatic cycle. That was the question at that time. Is Zika going to behave like dengue, which remained in humans and in urban settings, or is Zika going to behave as yellow fever, who went on a silvatic cycle in primates, and now we still have transmission of yellow fever?
Yeah.
And so that was the question, and we needed a place where we had primates, because of course the obvious host for human diseases, like the closest host is a primate. Yeah. And so there's a colleague at the university. He's a colleague and a friend from a long time. He has been working for 15 years in that area. And he has a very nice project trying to do some restoration, ecological restoration in that place. And he works with primates. So we decided to work in that area. And since he was there for such a long time, it was quite easy for us to access that zone and to work there. So luckily, one of my peers was not in that, like, the scary part of the field work was not in that area. But of course, it's an area that has suffered lots of conflict.
Because if you think of places like Puerto Berrio and Puerto Boyacá, there are the primates around there and up to Barranca Bermeja, because I have a friend who's a photographer who goes up there a bit, and jaguars and the ocelots and so on. But you've mentioned something that I find very interesting when you say, you know, would Zika become, I guess, would it stay in the countryside and into primates? Could you tell us a little bit more? Did it go into primates and stay there? Or, you know, can we be worried? Should we be worried?
No, in the end, what we could see was that, of course, we found some antibodies in some vertebrates against Zika, but we couldn't find any evidence of sylvatic transmission of the virus. So it is likely that the virus didn't go on a sylvatic cycle.
So it will remain, let's say, an urban problem.
Yes.
So okay, and chikungunya in the same circumstance. I don't know. I mean, we don't hear about them anymore.
No, you put you found the most interesting question we are still trying to solve, because since we were looking for viruses in general, we could find many other viruses circulating in that area. And by chance, because it's a different group of viruses, we were only working with viruses that belong to the group of the Zika virus. But by chance, we found another virus that was encephalitis, an encephalitis virus. And this virus belonged to the same family as chikungunya. So by chance, we started to look at viral sequences, and we found evidence of, well, the encephalitis virus was very spread, and maybe it was an outbreak ongoing during that time. But also we found a couple of mosquitoes that were probably with chikungunya, but in the end we tried to do everything in our hands to sequence those viruses. And last week we decided that we will work on the results, just saying that maybe it will be chikungunya, because we didn't have enough sample to keep working and to keep trying to be sure that it was chikungunya. So
as a scientist of such high ranking, you know, academic achievement and respect, it must absolutely destroy you to say, maybe.
No, but you know that science is built on uncertainty. We are never certain of something. You can be certain of something today, and then tomorrow another group discovers another thing that puts your research down. So, no, I'm not that disappointed. But, of course, the other side would be that if we could have those results, like if we could confirm that chikungunya was an asylvatic site, that would be like absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
So we are used to the maybes, we are not used to the certainty, but we want to have certainties for some things.
Well, I
that are very interesting.
You're already going through your diary looking at a time to find and to pursue this next, this next investigation into chikungunya, because it's there. It's not going anywhere. I'm pretty sure of that. Let's go on. And will you explain to my listeners exactly what Chagas disease is and how one gets it?
Okay, yes. Chagas disease is produced by a parasite that is called Trypanosoma cruzi. And this parasite is transmitted by insects that belong to a group that is called triatomin vectors. So these insects are very different from mosquitoes or flies, are larger in size. Their development is also different. And in Colombia, they are very associated to palm trees, sylvatic and also cultivated palm trees. So usually the way you get Chagas disease is because these insects bite you at night. And what is very interesting is that they don't have the parasite in their saliva like all the other diseases, but they have it in their feces. So as they feed, they engorge and then they defecate and they leave you the parasite in their feces. And the bite, when the insect leaves, the bite is so stinging that you start to scratch. And that way you put the parasite into the injury made by the insect. And that way the parasite enters your skin. So that's like the main transmission route. But there are new transmission routes that are being studied now. And the most important is the oral infection. And that means that you can have food. Some studies have shown that guava juice or guacamole were sources of infection. So the insect either can defecate in the food or during the preparation, there's an insect in there and by accident you don't see it and you just smash it in the food. And if you get the parasite by the oral way, well, feeding on contaminated food, the reaction is more aggressive and the symptoms come more rapidly. So the outcome of the disease is like worst if you get Chagas by oral transmission.
Because it's not cutaneous. I mean, if it's, it strikes me as, you know, the perfect way. You get bitten, it's itchy, you scratch it. I mean, talk about perfect evolution.
Yeah.
But that, to get it orally, I love guacamole, I love avocado, and I also like guava juice. And I spend a lot of time in the Magdalena River Valley because I've got my businesses in Mompós, and we're always eating both of those. And now I'm questioning my sanity because I am the perfect host for every tropical disease, believe me. And I can believe it. You know, you consume whatever the feces can being carried, and of course it's inside you. Of course it's going to be more aggressive and more.
Yes.
So fever, I imagine high fevers, probably diarrhea, probably vomiting,
and it goes to the gut. So you will have very bad inflammation and, well, symptoms are quite aggressive. So people usually go to the hospital immediately. But it is unlikely to get, I mean, you have been lucky to get that many diseases because it's really unlikely to get those. So, and it's not right to like condemn some kinds of food. But what you would need to do is like to look at the place where you are, and if you know there are these bugs, like be extra cautious. And of course, there are regions where you can find these bugs very easily. So that's like the way to go.
One of the things you said is that they are very related to the palm, and that is, I immediately think of the palm cultivations. I think there are a lot, obviously, in Cesar, Norte Santander, all of that area, Morrison, up around there. And, of course, in Guaviare, in places where they've been cutting down all the forests for palm plantations. So, obviously, your investigations have found there to be an increase in Chagas and other illnesses around there.
We have seen that the insects can colonize these palms, and that they are infected and that infection rates are high, because for these insects, infection rates are quite high. But what is very like shocking is that somehow I have many friends or even family who are involved in this business, and they don't want to talk about this with me. It's like they prefer to ignore the problem than to do something about it. And what I used to say, they say, no, but you work with diseases, so like you are not that popular among us. No, if you work on biodiversity, we want you to come and see and show how biodiverse this ecosystem is. But if you work on diseases, you are like a threat. I don't know. But what I say is that this is the situation. We cannot pretend that it is not happening. We have oil palm plantations and we have Chagas disease. So we should work together to find solutions and, of course, to try to make the best of this and not just pretend that this is not happening, because it is happening.
Is Chagas imported as well?
No. Okay, Chagas so is also
so a beautiful biodiversity. I think that's really, really, really fascinating what you say. You know, your family, those of you that I have extended family as well here who are involved, you know, and they want to get further involved. And now I'm going to tell them this. So they will be, I'm already, you know, known as problematic in these issues, because at the end, this is an increase due to a loss of endemic biodiversity, because, you know, I've done a lot of episodes on this, how extensive cattle farming, palm cultivations, climate change, of course, but illegal mining are leading to this elimination of what was originally there and has given, well, has permitted these things like Chagas to become normal as opposed to something extraordinary. I've read it in your articles, but what is your feeling on this as well?
Well, I was going to tell you exactly about that all of these diseases are part of that group that are called neglected tropical diseases, and it has also it's also related to what you were saying before about the treatment for leishmaniasis. So for us, it's very frustrating that as scientists, we could do more if we could have the necessary funding. And in the case of palm, what I think is, if this is such a good business, why not putting some money into this kind of research, and we could find solutions together. And of course, in this way, we can like have the best of the two worlds. If you put money into research for basic science, but also for diagnostic alternatives or treatment alternatives, this is something that is very unfunded or poorly funded here in Colombia. So, of course, this is like getting worse. We are having more pathogens coming out. We are having more diseases spreading. And I used to say that, of course, vector-borne diseases won't disappear with all the changes that we are doing. They will move to our houses or close to our houses. So as we can see with dengue and with Zika and chikungunya, those mosquitoes are like our pets. We are breeding them. We are keeping their places. And so it's like our responsibility also to find solutions.
Looking after our families of infectious diseases. Now, there were some terminologies there, as you said, neglected tropical diseases, but I was also interested in sort of new emerging diseases and re-emerging infectious diseases. A re-emerging one would be an increase of dengue, or is that a new emerging one? I don't know how you establish what is what.
You from the health languages we use is like is different from the language we use in biology, because you know that when you say an endemic disease, it doesn't make much sense from the biology perspective, because an endemic species is one that you only find in one place.
Yeah.
But what we refer to with diseases is endemic is a disease that you expect to have a certain threshold of transmission every year. Like, okay, it's expected for us to have this many number of cases. And when I think of a re-emerging disease, is probably one that was controlled or was under that threshold for a long period of time, and you're seeing an increase, like it's coming back and it's having an increase of cases above that threshold. And the new pathogens are the ones that we still don't know that they are there. Reemerging are things that we know there are there, but are increasing in numbers. So that's the difference.
Well, then that brings me that, because again, I read on one of your articles, it says that, you know, malaria was targeted for elimination worldwide, I suppose, in 2030, but around 2016, 9 countries in Latin America reported its increase. You know, again, it's the pervasive transformation of natural areas, agriculture, cattle ranches, deforestation. So would that be a re-emerging disease?
Yes.
Malaria.
And you know that the story for malaria is very interesting, because we were doing some research in the department of Cordoba, and I wanted, like, I will make a parenthesis to something that you were saying from the beginning, like, I work in many diseases. And that's also something that is quite different from the way these diseases were studied before, because it was very common to have a specialist in each disease. And when they would go to the field, they were just looking for that disease.
Yeah.
With this approach of disease ecology, we go to the field and try to find everything together, like everything is there, so why not looking at everything? And so this project that I was mentioning was aiming at studying the multiple diseases, Chagas, Leish, malaria, and dengue in this department. And we started to work with malaria, and we started to get the results. We started to see that we were having higher prevalence of Plasmodium vivax. No, Plasmodium falciparum. Huh. And what was common in Colombia before that was that the prevalence of Plasmodium falciparum was lower than vivax, and vivax was higher, like 80% vivax and just 20% falciparum. And we started to see that we were having samples with lots of falciparum positives. And of course, my first reaction was, we did everything wrong.
Yeah.
We are getting the bad results. So we keep trying, because this was very weird. We were like seeing different vectors being the most abundant, the parasite that we were not expecting being the most abundant. And so while we were working on this, it coincides exactly with that time where the epidemiology of malaria was changing. So it was very surprising when we started like to write the article to see, like, my God, we're like seeing in real time how this thing is changing. And our data reflected what was happening. The proportions of parasites and vectors were changing. And of course, those are related to environmental changes.
And of course, Cordoba being a huge agricultural department as well. But of course, it is absolutely massive. And it's not just the agriculture and so on there. But so the falciparum is not the one I have. I have vivax. But the falciparum is the one that's cerebral.
Yes.
And I, you know, mistakenly until today, believed that falciparum was really not found in South America very much. I thought it was more in Africa. So what do we attribute this change to? As you said, like the agriculture and so on, but when? How?
Well, first, that's an imported species. Mm. That's an imported species, and it's very common in Africa, of course.
Yeah.
is the most prevalent parasite in Africa. But now in Colombia, you have like 50-50. 50
really?
Falciparum, 50 vivax, yeah.
And I assume it's more dangerous for a human.
Yes, because falciparum is the one who can lead to cerebral malaria. Yeah.
So I do know, I mean, a family friend has died of that in Africa. So, and then we do, there are, actually, before I get into another serious topic, it's all serious, but I want to ask you, you've been to all these places, how many of the diseases have you had?
None.
Oh. All right.
I usually get a bacterial infection, and the only parasite I had was amoebas.
Ah.
Like entamoeba, but yeah, but my students, that's the same question my students ask, like, how do you do that? And well, I'm very cautious and I'm very obsessed with wearing protection, but I must confess that my brain doesn't understand that I go to the same places, and when I go on a field work trip, I get all the precautions, but when I get on holidays, I forget about that. So it's confusing, but anyways, I've been lucky, I guess.
But I think, you know, with the kind of studies that you do, you're never on holiday. You're always, especially if you're going to somewhere warm, you know, somewhere low level, you're always thinking about what could be or what there's this. Now, my friend who's in the military, who was in the special forces for a long time, he never got any of these diseases because he wore gloves. He put on, he spent money to insure. And all of his friends or colleagues who didn't, they were the ones who got these things. So it's truly, you care for yourself very much when you're going to these places because you are at higher risk. Of course you are, because you're going in and out. I wanted to ask because, you know, obviously we've been living through a pandemic, and COVID has erased the public discourse about any other disease. It must be really frustrating for you, because I imagine that cases of malaria and dengue, leishmaniasis, chagas, probably are increasing because we're not paying attention to them. Have you found that to be the case? Because, you know, COVID pandemic essentially erased our lives before the pandemic. What has been the fallout for your field?
Well, of course, I also started to work on COVID because since my lab had experience in virus detection, I think that a very interesting and nice thing happened here, and that was that the universities, as soon as the pandemic started, the universities put their research to support the diagnostic capacity in the country. So that was something that for me was very positive. So the National Institute of Health certified some labs around the country to support the diagnosis, and Universidad de los Andes did a very big contribution on that. And so, of course, we started to get funds to do COVID research. So that was like what I would say most of the groups working on tropical diseases were doing at the time. Okay. But what is very nice also is that some of these researches can be applied to to the diseases that we had, that we used to work before the pandemic. So, for example, we were working on a project aiming at developing a diagnostic portable tool to remote locations for COVID. But then we started to apply that to dengue, Zika, chikungunya, and leishmaniasis. So now we are using that technology to try to improve our diagnostic capacity for our other diseases. So that's the bright side of this. But of course, I guess that we had some on the report. Yeah. And I guess that something very interesting happened with those urban viral diseases such as Zika and dengue, because the next Zika epidemic was expected to happen in 2020. All the modeling, the epidemiological modeling that was done when the first Zika epidemic was happening here in America, all the models were predicting that around 2020, we would have the second wave. Huh. And since everyone was locked and like there was no movement, it is likely that it didn't happen. It could be one of the reasons why it didn't happen. So we know that movement, people movement, is one of the main drivers for those urban diseases. Mm-hmm. And having everyone like in lockdown maybe positively affected transmission. But of course, I guess that we will have under reports for all the other diseases. For example, malaria. It's likely that we were having malaria cases, but they were being underreported.
So when can we expect the next outbreak of Zika then?
We don't know.
Okay, please.
We are waiting. We are waiting for the cases to, start rising.
Either. and then, okay, I have to ask, because COVID, of course, you know, people behave as if it's gone away, but of course it hasn't. It's not going anywhere. You know, that's the reality. But of course, there's all this chatter about it starting in that market in Wuhan, jumping from bats or whatever it is, live animals, to humans. And you do a lot of investigation into the zoonotic transmission. That's where we talk about, you know, a disease jumping from an animal to a human. What? Tell me about it, because it's, you know, did COVID come that way? I don't know if you can answer that, but
yes, of course, there is evidence that COVID had zoonotic origin. I mean, the alternative is that it was produced in a lab. No, it was a pathogen that was circulating and that it came out. Like for us, it's quite obvious that that's a very likely, answer for this virus. For many people, maybe zoonosis and producing a lab is at the same level of absurdity, but zoonotic transmission is real and it happens.
And are there then transmissions of that type that could take place here in Colombia as well? I mean, have you found parasites or so on, or diseases within, I don't know, monkeys that there's a primates, there's a fear that they might jump to humans?
We haven't done like such type of works, because usually what they do when they are finding the next pathogen X is that you need to go and look for all the viruses that are present in those vertebrates. So we don't do that. We don't find we don't look for pathogen X. But we try to see how the virus we know are behaving. And something that was very nice or I don't know, it was for me like a rational decision, was that after COVID and the calls that we are seeing for funding this year, they are trying to avoid anything related with COVID. We put too many funds for COVID and it was good, but now it's time to move forward. And so now there's a list of diseases that are prioritized for funding and are viruses that are there or bacteria that are there. And we need to understand how they are behaving. But one of the findings that we had that was very interesting regarding your question was that one of my students who was working on primate malaria in that Magdalena region, she was looking at malaria parasites in primates. And there's a non-invasive way of sampling where you can get feces of the primates and there you can find the parasite. So you don't need to dart the primate and get blood. And in that work, which was also published a couple of years ago, she found evidence of falciparum infecting these primates. And that's very surprising, because you don't expect to have that parasite in primates, but you expect that parasite to be only in humans. And so this implies that primates are getting infected from infected humans. So, exactly. So for zoonotic transmission, we are always thinking like, Sylvatic animals are like the risk for us humans, that if we look the other way, it's also likely. So it's a very important argument also for conservation, that we need to see the whole picture and we don't need to see that just happening one way.
It's like a biological way of saying decolonizing our thought process. If I'm thinking of the humanities there, but you have to undo everything that you've learned in that respect, that we are the danger to them, as opposed, I mean, like parasites and so on, and viral, and as opposed to them to us, which is the way we've been entirely brought up.
Yes.
Wow. I honestly, we could talk for hours. I am just thrilled with this conversation, and I know that my listeners are, you know, they're going to probably be tired of me for, you know, there's some hero worship going on here, because it's really fascinating in what you're talking about, and your knowledge is so broad. That's the thing. It's not, you know, you're not just, it's not just Chagas, it's malaria, it's Zika, it's chikungunya, it's dengue, it's leishmaniasis. And then beyond it, you're talking about COVID. You know, you've, as we'd say, you know, you've appropriated this knowledge about all of them. So can I just say thank you so much for your time on this rainy Bogota day? It took us 5 attempts to get a good internet connection between Bogota to Bogota. Camila Gonzalez Rosas, thank you so much for sharing so unselfishly your knowledge.
No, Richard, I'm so happy. This is one of the things I very enjoy, and I really like to talk about what I am passionate about, and hopefully this knowledge will cause some emotions to some people, and we can take this group of diseases out of the neglect. So I'm happy to talk to you anytime.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Hopefully there is no further pandemic to suffer, but if there is something, or if you get a model together that says the next Zika outbreak will be this, get in touch and we'll warn everyone, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely, we'll do.
Thank you. Well, this has been episode 461, and I've been talking to Dr. Camila González Rosas, who's the director and associate professor of the Department of Biological Sciences at the Universidad de los Andes, that's downtown Bogota, and she's also a researcher for the Center for Investigation into Microbiology and Tropical Parasitology. We've been discussing disease ecology, chikungunya, Zika, COVID, Chagas, malaria, dengue, leishmaniasis, and so much more. I think it's been a phenomenal episode, as every week, but I really, really have enjoyed this one as well. And so we will be back next week with further conversations with people talking something to do with Colombia. Now we'll go over to our sponsors, but thank you again to everyone for listening. It's been a great episode. And please continue to tune in, continue to share the podcast. And if you're feeling generous, check out www.patreon.com/Columbia Calling. And for less than the cost of a coffee in Starbucks, you can sponsor us a little bit. So thank you again, everyone, and bye-bye for this week.
The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. The Columbia Calling podcast is also proud to say that we are sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator in Colombia, providing a large range of private day tours, transportation, and bespoke packages throughout Colombia since 2017. By popular demand, from January 2023, they will be providing exclusive small group shared tours for those aged 50 and over. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's colombiacalling.co, or the Plan My Trip form on the BNB Colombia Tours website. That's bnbcolombia.com. And they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all your questions and to start the planning of your Colombia adventure. So please support our sponsors, our patrons here on the Colombia Calling podcast. That's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you again.